Song of Solomon, chapter 3, is where we pick things up tonight. As we continue through the Bible from Genesis to Revelation, and we find ourselves in Song of Solomon, chapter 3. Hit Isaiah and turn left, and you'll be pretty close. The Song of Solomon, as we saw last week, is a love song. And it's a love song in which Solomon writes it, inspired by the Holy Spirit. And it is a song about love, God's way. And it is a song about the love of God for His people, the love of Jesus Christ for His church, but also a description of the love that God intends between a man and a woman and the expression of that love within the confines of the commitment of marriage. And in these first couple of chapters, we've taken a look as Solomon and the Shulamite have looked back on remembering their courtship days and remembering their wedding. And so there was the thoughts of their wedding day and then her self-consciousness on the wedding night and then remembering the early days of their courtship and marveling that, wow, it's turned into this, you know, we're married and we're together and the beauty of that. And also, the rejoicing over being able to, you know, live together and sleep together within the confines of marriage. And I mean that quite apart from the sexual relationship, just to be together all of the time, the way that marriage allows that to happen. And then, Solomon, such a wise man in his dealing with the Shulamite, reassuring her constantly in the expressions of his love. And she telling her friends, the daughters of Jerusalem, that marriage is worth it. It's worth waiting for. It's worth keeping yourself pure for. And then she talks about how excited she was to see her beloved come every time he would come to visit and how excited she would be over that. And then at the end of chapter 3 in verse 15, we saw the warning concerning the little foxes. And then in verse 16, she talked about how confident she is in her husband's love, in Solomon's love. And then the remembrance of those early days, those courtship days, and of their wedding day continues through the first five verses of chapter 3. And so her mind goes back to when they were going together, and she loves him so much that she even dreams about him. So I don't know about you, when you were, you know, kind of going together with your husband or wife, you know, she would dream of him. And now the wedding's apparently getting very close, and so she kind of has a nightmare. She worries that it's getting close, and we love one another, and I think something terrible is going to happen. You know, what if he doesn't, you know, show up for the wedding, or what if he changes his mind, and that kind of anxiety. And I don't know if you went through that, but she did. In verse 1 of chapter 3, by night on my bed, I sought the one I love. She's dreaming. I sought him, but I did not find him. I will rise now, I said, and go about the city in the streets and in the squares, and I will seek the one I love. And I sought him, but I did not find him. And the watchmen who go about the city, they found me, and to whom I said, have you seen the one I love? And so over again, four times through here, the one I love, the one I love, the one I love, the one I love. And so she loves him so much, and she doesn't want anything to go wrong. And she says in verse 4, scarcely had I passed by them when I found the one I love. And I held him and would not let him go. Tell me you love me. Tell me you're never going to, you know, and until I had brought him to the house of my mother. Now, there's no safer place than that. And into the chamber of her who conceived me. So she said, I'm going to bring you where I can never lose you. I'm going to bring you to my mom's house and where our purity can be safe. and in, you know, at mom's house with mom there. And so she brings him there. And then she says, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the does of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases. And so again, that reminder to stay sexually pure and only awaken the physical relationship within the confines of marriage. And so, and then now in verse 6, she heads into the memory of her wedding day or her wedding night. And the interesting thing was, in that culture, the groom, part of the ceremony was, today we just kind of, everybody meets at the church. Well, in that culture, the groom would leave his house and he would come in all of his glory, whatever that was. My glory was a 65 T-Bird, very, very oxidized paint, white interior. The interior was immaculate, I will say that for it. Nice powder blue tux, big, wide 1970s lapel, huh? And a shag haircut. Here he comes, baby, you know, and so, you know, she was blinded with love, apparently. And, but, you know, you put your best foot forward. And so he would come to her house. She wouldn't know when he was going to come. And then, but he would come. She was always to be ready for him to come. And then he would take her to go and live then in his house in his city. And so she's waiting in her hometown, which is somewhere in the northern region of Israel, up in the area of the Galilee, up near Lebanon. Solomon is coming from Jerusalem, a pretty fair distance, to pick up this bride. And so she remembers now what it was like when he came on the wedding day. You know, see, I think it's great. She said, who is this coming out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke? And so he's coming, and obviously he's surrounded by men, as we'll see in a moment, and he's made this special throne up that he's on, and he's being carried on, and the apparently incense going like crazy and the whole thing. So she sees this, you know, pillars of smoke, you know, oh, he's awesome, and perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, all of the fragrance coming off, with all of the merchants' fragrant powders. And so he apparently was, you know, this is the good stuff. This is the expensive stuff that he's using. Any of the perfumes or the rare fragrances that he could get anywhere around the world, that's what he used. It wasn't just some junky stuff that he put on, you know, when he went to meet her. And then she said, oh, behold, it's Solomon's couch. And it's kind of referring to this, as it says in my footnote, a portable enclosed chair, kind of like a throne, you know, that could be carried or be rolled on wheels. And with Solomon's couch, 60 valiant men around it, undoubtedly his friends and his closest companions. Of the valiant of Israel, they all hold swords, being expert in war. Every man has his sword on his thigh because of the fear of the night. Now, this is really great, because Solomon is coming to pick up his bride, and he considers her so valuable that he brings this tremendous entourage of the most valiant men in Israel. In other words, he's protective of her. Doesn't want to come and pick her up and then be taking her back home and get ambushed. You know, that was a possibility in those days. Beautiful when a man will protect his bride, will protect the one that he loves. It's a beautiful thing. I think it's great. And you know, when I walk with Karen, now I don't carry a sword or anything like that, but you know, it's just a deal with me that when we'd walk down the street, she's on the inside and I'm on the outside. She knows it. She knows when she's on the outside and I'm trying to get out, she just slips in there and does. It's just little things that just communicate that you're valuable to me and I'm protective of you, and it's important. And so he was, and she appreciated. And so here comes Solomon coming to pick her up. Oh, I remember it like it was yesterday. And of the wood of Lebanon, Solomon the king made himself a palanquin, which is, again, my notes, it's that chair again that he had. He made it out of the good stuff also. And he made its pillars of silver, its support of gold, its seat of purple. This is all the best. Its interior paved with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. Go forth, O daughters of Zion, and see King Solomon with the crown with which his mother, speaking of Bathsheba, crowned him on the day of his espousals, the day of the gladness of his heart. So I'd say I love wedding days like this. She's pumped, he's pumped, everybody's excited. And, you know, when you go to do a wedding and like one of them's like, oh boy, what day is this? You know, and the whole thing, it's troubling. But here's that, just that excitement. She's excited. He's excited. Everyone is around them is excited. And that's the way it should be. I'll tell you, it ought to be that way on the wedding day. Chapter 4. So then we get to eavesdrop in a little bit on their honeymoon conversation on their wedding night. And so we have the joys of the physical relationship really brought out in this particular passage. And the beloved Solomon, he speaks to his bride now on their wedding night, and he says, "Behold, you are fair, my love." And then just so she understands, you can't ever tell a woman this often enough, he repeats it, "Behold, you are fair." He looks at her and he goes, "Outrageous." He said, "You have dove's eyes behind your veil." Now, she would wear a veil. It would be customary in that culture. But now on the wedding day, of course, the veil comes off. And so he gets to see her eyes fully. And he says, "You have dove's eyes behind your veil." Now, a dove, one of the most beautiful birds that you can watch is a dove. It really is. They're very peaceful, beautiful bird. And so he's just watching her, watching him. And her eyes are very, very peaceful and very, very beautiful. He says, "Your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Mount Gilead." Yeah, this is obviously cultural. You know, what is it? Like, you never comb it or something. But he's talking about the goats of the northern region of Israel. That would typically be a black-haired goat and very, very beautiful. So she probably had beautiful, shining black hair. "Your teeth are like a flock of shorn sheep." Your teeth are like sheep that have just been shaved. And so, what's he, they're white. Then you got white teeth. It's nice on the wedding night to have white teeth. He says, "which have come up from the washing." So not only are they white, but they're clean. Now, you laugh, personal hygiene related to physical intimacy is so important. It is so important. It is not right for one person in the marriage to let themselves go in terms of personal hygiene. And so he appreciated the fact that she took care of herself, took care of herself. You know, "I got to kiss you. You know, brush your teeth and keep them brushed." And so it's an important thing. I don't want to go any further than that, but it's an important thing. Then he's continuing to talk about her teeth, and he says, "Every one of which bears twins." In other words, they're matched on each side. There's none missing. And he says, and none is barren among them." And you're not, again, you're not missing any teeth. "Your lips are like a strand of scarlet." And the idea is a thread. So she apparently had thin red lips as he's describing her. "And your mouth is lovely. Your temples behind your veil are like a piece of pomegranate." And the pomegranate being red. And he's probably not just talking about her temples, but the whole cheek structure. Now, fascinating, as you watch Solomon here, men, women, you tune me up for a second here. As you listen to him, he's very lavish in his praise of her. Very, very lavish in his praise of her. The other thing that we notice about him is he's on his wedding night, and he doesn't cut to the chase. He begins with her eyes, talks about her, you know, facial features. He's dealing with a human being. He's dealing with a human being. And he wants her to know that he thinks she is beautiful in every way. Another thing that's interesting, and I won't get graphic here, but there is a delightful pace to what he is involved in here. He is taking his time, and can bear rewards. And so lessons here, and we'll leave that where it is. Again, you're rich preacher-like minds to carry this all where it ought to be. He said, "Your neck is like the Tower of David. And now, did she have a real long neck? No. It's probably referring to how she carried herself. And a lot of the beauty is how a person carries themselves. And so she probably had good posture and kept her neck straight. Built for an armory on which to hang 1,000 bucklers, all shields of mighty men. And so, beautiful as he looked at her. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies. And then he says, until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. And here he's probably talking about her breasts and the frankincense and the myrrh that scents her body. And he's talking about they enjoyed one another all through the night until the day breaks. Now, the beautiful thing here in chapter 4 is there's no sense of inhibition among either of them. They are really enjoying one another. They seem to be enjoying one another greatly, really celebrating the beauty of the sexual relationship that God has intended for man and woman within marriage. He goes on in verse 7, and he said, you are all fair, my love, and there is no spot in you. In other words, he looks at her and says, in my eyes, there's not a flaw. There's not a flaw. Now, in any given culture, there is this ideal that is given as it relates to beauty. And so you have this ideal. How many men and women in a culture live up to that kind of an ideal? Very, very few of us. But that's not the issue. In this man's eyes, because of his heart towards his wife, he could see no flaws in her. And that's a beautiful thing, a beautiful, reassuring thing for her. And then in verse 8, he says, come with me from Lebanon, my spouse. Come with me from Lebanon. Look from the top of Amana. It's probably not pronounced that. From the top of Senir and Hermon and from the lion's dens, from the mountains of the leopards. And so she was from Lebanon. And so he says to her, come with me from Lebanon, my spouse. In other words, don't let your mind drift back home or drift to other things. Let's give this your full attention. And so he draws her into what they're involved in. You have ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. You have ravished my heart, ravished is the word, with one look of your eyes and with one link of your necklace. How fair is your love, my sister, my spouse. How much better than wine is your love and the scent of your perfumes than all spices. Your lips, O my spouse, drip as the honeycomb. Milk and honey, that's the most luxurious thing in that culture, are under your tongue. And so there's that evidence that she's not passive. She's quite involved also. And the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. Now, they've come into marriage as virgins. And yet here, as you look at chapter 4, there is no sense that they have missed out on anything because they have come into marriage as virgins. It's just the beauty to explore one another and enjoy one another. You don't need experience for the physical relationship within marriage to be good. That's something that can grow together. And then he describes his bride, and he says, a garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse, a spring shut up, a fountain sealed. And he's talking about her virginity. She was a virgin to her wedding night, and he appreciated that. Verse 13, your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with pleasant fruits, fragrant henna with spikenard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, and all the chief spices, a fountain of gardens, a well of living waters, and streams from Lebanon. And so he likens his bride to a beautiful garden. Have you ever walked into a beautiful garden, and you see the beauty of the garden, and you go, whoa.
And that's what happened to him on his wedding night. He saw her, he goes, ooh, that's very nice. And so that's what he's doing here. He's very, very appreciative. And then the Shulamite says in verse 16, his bride, awake, O north wind, and come, O south, and blow upon my garden. Notice that word, my, that its spices may flow out. Let my beloved come to his garden, speaking of her body, and eat its pleasant fruits. And so there's that repetition of the word my. She recognized that her body was her body to give to whomever she chose to do so. And now on her wedding night, there's that choosing. I'm going to give my garden, give my body to this man who loves me so much. And so she presents herself, and then Solomon apparently doesn't seem to waste any time. In chapter 5, verse 1, I have come to my garden, my sister, my spouse. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice, and I have eaten my honeycomb with my honey, and I have drunk my wine with my milk. And so this the beauty of him, he's saying, I am satisfied. I am satisfied here. And then he gives this wholehearted endorsement to the married life to his friends. And he says, eat, O friends, drink, yes, drink deeply, O beloved ones. And so his endorsement of the married life. Now, in verse 2 of chapter 5, they apparently have been married for a little while, because you notice, she says, I sleep. So she's probably dreaming of something that really happened. And so she says, I sleep, but my heart is awake. It's the voice of my beloved. He knocks saying, open for me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. So he calls her my sister, my love. He doesn't call her my bride here in this. And so it indicates that there's a distance of time between the wedding night and now. So they've been married for a while now. And there's some danger that can occur after we've been married a while with one another. And one of the dangers is we begin to take one another for granted. And that's what happens. So she's sleeping, but her heart is awake. She hears the voice of her beloved coming to the door. He knocks, saying, open for me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one, for my head is covered with dew, and my locks with the drops of the night, his hair, you know, moist. And then she responds, and she thinks to herself, or she perhaps says it, she said, I have taken off my robe. How can I put it on again? I've washed my feet, and how can I defile them? In other words, she's saying, I'm all ready for bed. And so that's kind of, she delays in his approaching her. And so she says, wait a second, I just took my robe off and I just washed my feet and everything. I'm ready for bed. What do you got in mind? And so verse 4, my beloved put his hand by the latch of the door. Hey, you know, don't sweat it. You took your robe off and your feet are clean. I'll come to you. And so he tries to the latch of the door, but the door is latched and he can't get in. She delays, and then my heart, she says, yearned for him. I arose to open for my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the lock. So he has left now in her delay, and what he has rightly understood as a refusal on her part towards his approach to be physically involved with her. And she gets to the door to grab the latch to open it, and there's myrrh on the latch, confirming to her that he had something more than just coming in out of the cold in mind. And then she opened verse 6, for my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and was gone. And my heart went out to him when he spoke. And I sought him, but I couldn't find him. And I called him, but he gave me no answer. So now, you know, she's crying out for him. The watchmen who went about the city, they found me, they struck me, they wounded me. The keepers from the walls took my veil from me. Now, this probably didn't happen to her physically, but happening perhaps in her dream. And then she says, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him that I am lovesick. And sometimes it isn't until something is lost that it ends up being appreciated within the marriage. And she only appreciates him now that she's lost him. And so often that happens within a marriage relationship. I cannot tell you how many times through the years it is only after the neglect of a marriage, sometimes for years, that then there is the loss of the marriage or the loss of the other spouse for one reason or another, and then there is no longer, I mean, then there's that idea, I would never take it this for granted ever again if I just had one more chance. And there's that great danger after we've been married for a while to begin to take one another for granted. And we have to be so careful of it. He knocks for admission, and for the moment she's indifferent to him, doesn't arise. She begins to make some excuses, some very poor excuses. I just took off my robe and I washed my feet and I don't want to get them dirty. And those are the excuses that she makes, and then he leaves. And now she goes searching after him, and then her friends rebuke her in verse 9. And they say, what is your beloved more than any other beloved? You talk about him, he's all special, he's all this and all everything. If he's all that, then why do you treat him that way? What is your beloved more than any other beloved, O fairest among women? What is your beloved more than any other beloved that you so charge us? And so they rebuke her. You tell us that he's your beloved and that he means the world to you, but if he really does, then why have you treated him that way? If he's so wonderful, why'd you let him go? And I'd say, as we look at this with its spiritual applications, the same thing can be said as it relates to spiritually. A person says, oh, I love the Lord, I love, you know, this and all that and everything. And then, you know, there's that backsliding. And then the world could look and say, well, you say you love him and he's all of this to you and everything like that. But if you really love him, why do you treat him that way? And so, again, the spiritual application can continue through here. It's interesting to me that as it relates to, and I think this is a very important section of the Bible here with her failure here. And sometimes it can be the man that'll fail in the same way related to the physical relationship. Oftentimes in a marriage, and even in Christian marriages, there is one partner who walks on eggshells related to the other partner in the area of the sexual relationship, and it should never happen. It should never happen. The sexual relationship should never be used as a way of manipulating or controlling a marriage. And so often, a marriage can be dominated by the person who, has the least desire related to the physical relationship and not be sensitive to the other partner, and it can lead to real problems in the marriage. In fact, this is so common, even among Christians, that Paul addresses it by the Holy Spirit in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And let me read it to you. You might even write it in the margin, verses 3 through 5. He said, let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, talking about the physical relationship. He is not to defraud her. And likewise also the wife to the husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourself to fasting and prayer and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. In other words, in the Christian marriage, one partner can't say, I'm going to fast and I'm going to pray and I'm going to give up sex for 2 weeks. The other partner has a say in that. You can't just do that. And so our bodies belong to one another. There has to be mutual consent for there to be an abstaining of the physical relationship. And so there isn't to be the depriving of one another in this area. One of the things that's important about this is that sometimes within a marriage relationship, the sex drive among the two people, it's not synchronized. It's not the same. one partner can have a greater sex drive than the other partner. And the other partner has got to take that into account. There can't be these kind of excuses in putting him off or putting her off. Where then are they going to go? God has ordained that physical relationship, that there be satisfaction within the marriage relationship. And so there has to be that willingness on my part, on both parts in the marriage, to satisfy that sexual desire of the other partner. And so it all has to be taken into account. And sometimes one partner is going to be want to involve themselves and the other isn't, and all of these kinds of things. And, you know, we are there to serve one another, is in every area of marriage. Now, here, obviously, he is desiring her, but she is more interested in not getting cold and going to bed, or not getting her feet dirty. Those are not good enough excuses for not involving myself physically with the other person. That's not good enough. Oh, I took off my robe, you know, or something like that. Not again. This is the second time this month, you know, or whatever it might be, you know. What, you're turning into an animal now, you know, or some kind of a deal. And I tell you, that if you're in that kind of a category, you can be creating tremendous bitterness in the other partner. You can't do that. God says that you can't do that. Those aren't good enough excuses. Now, on the other hand, if she's just had surgery, guys, you know, you have to be sensitive there. Or excruciating headache or a body cast or something like that. Or, you know, there needs to be understanding that works both ways. And it can be guys and gals. And, you know, I don't want to generalize or anything like that. But there needs to be sensitivity. You know what I'm saying. You know what I'm saying. You can create tremendous distance within a marriage if one person is insensitive in that area. So one of the things that happens in a failure like this is that the Shulamite now, she has fresh appreciation for her husband. Notice in verse 10, my beloved is white and ruddy, chief among 10,000. His head is like the finest gold. His locks are wavy and black as a raven. So Solomon apparently had black hair. His eyes are like doves by the rivers of waters, washed with milk and fitly set. His cheeks are like a bed of spices, like banks of scented herbs. His lips are lilies dripping with liquid myrrh. And so what she's saying is, he's just good looking. He's handsome. And then she's also going to say, he happens to be a hunk too. His hands are rods of gold set with beryl, and his body is carved ivory inlaid with sapphires. His legs are pillars of marble set on bases of fine gold. All right. His countenance is like Lebanon. Excellent is the cedars. His mouth is most sweet. Yes, he is altogether lovely. And on top of that, the biggest thing is, this is my beloved and this is my friend. Yeah, he's handsome. Yeah, he's good looking. But let me end with the fact that he also happens to be my friend. Friendship in marriage. Next to the Lord Jesus, Karen is my best friend. We have always been friends. And so this is my beloved and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. And so now she's that fresh appreciation that occurs. And so she just stops in her failure, and she begins just to reassess all that she has in Solomon. And I'll tell you, I think that's a great thing to do. We live in a culture that all it does is constantly plant dissatisfaction within our hearts about everything, including our spouses. And that happens, and there has to be a time before a crisis occurs. It's just good to take time and just step aside and look at them and begin to think about how blessed I am to have them as a part of my life. This is one of God's daughters that he has blessed me with. This is one of God's sons that he has blessed me with. And to begin to think about how blessed I am to have him. And I hate soap operas. I hate romance novels, and I hate Christian romance novels. This kind of stuff that is just escapism in all of this, give yourself to the marriage. Give yourself to the reality of what's there and what you have in him, and not heading off into this dream world that's that's there. And so a couple of weeks ago, they had in the living section these Christian romance novels. I look at the cover. I said, what is this kind of cover that Bible talks about modesty? You can't have covers like that and call it Christian. And so, you know, but here, that fresh appreciation that's so important, because if I don't stop and appreciate what there is to appreciate in my spouse, the day can come when I will lose something that I'll regret. And so very, very important. Then in chapter 6, verse 1, the daughters of Jerusalem say, where has your beloved gone, O fairest among women? Where has your beloved turned aside that we may seek him with you? And the Shulamite says, my beloved has gone to his garden, to the beds of spices, to feed his flock in the gardens and to gather lilies. I am my beloved's and my beloved's is mine. He feeds his flock among the lilies. In other words, she's informing her friends, he's back home and everything is all right. Now, look at the response of the beloved, Solomon, to the failure of the Shulamite and how graciously he handles her failure, how easy he makes restoration. And he begins by saying, oh, my love, you're as beautiful as Tirzah, lovely as Jerusalem. Awesome is an army with banners. Turn your eyes from me, for you've overcome me. Your hair is like the flock of goats going down from Gilead. And so he doesn't rebuke her or anything like that. There's just love as he once again just begins to delight himself in her beauty. And here she is. She's failed. She knows that she failed. He knows that she failed. It just used to be the other way around, but that's the way that it worked. Everyone knows that, and he disregards all of that, and he just responds with praise. It wasn't, oh, now you want me, huh? Okay, well, you're going to pay for that, I'll tell you. Never hear the end of this, you know. And that whole, listen, when a person makes a mistake in marriage, don't make them grovel in order for there to be restoration. Because the day will come where you'll fail too. You'll fall short too. The relationship. Marriage is made up of two sinners. I remember one guy got angry at me for saying that one time. What do you mean marriage is made up of two sinners? Don't you know that we never sin anymore now that we're Christians? Boy, give me that. Don't give me that. I'm not going to get into the whole doctrinal thing as it relates to that, but that's an idiotic remark. But anyway, we don't want to get unperky here. But marriage, it's made up of two sinners. We all fall short. We're all less than perfect in our marriage. That means that grace is going to be necessary. And I'll tell you, when the other person fails and you respond with grace, it will provoke such an appreciation within that other person more than anything else could. It will really produce something within that other person. It just makes them fall in love with you even more, because that's why how we fall in love with the Lord, don't we? We love him as much as we do, and then he shows us even more grace. And you just think, no more love can come out of my heart, and yet his grace provokes even greater love out of my heart. Grace really does wonderful things within a marriage. It's very, very appreciated. And so he said again, verse 5, turn your eyes away from me, for they have overcome me. Your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep which have come up from the washing. Everyone bears twins, and none is barren among them. Like a piece of pomegranate are your temples behind your veil. And so you look at that and you say, well, is he repeating himself? Because there's only so much you can say about hair and teeth and temples and that kind of thing. No, but Solomon is saying when he repeats it, he says, you're as beautiful to me as ever. You're as beautiful to me as ever. What happened here hasn't changed my love for you at all. He said, there are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. My dove, my perfect one, is the only one. The only one of her mother, the favorite of the one who bore her. The daughters saw her and called her blessed, the queens and the concubines, and they praised her. Who is she who looks forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, awesome as an army with banners? And then the Shulamite
respond so thankful for his grace. I went down to the garden of nuts to see the verdure of the valley, to see whether the vine had budded and the pomegranates had bloomed. And before I was even aware, my soul had made me as the chariots of my noble people. And so her perspective of the reconciliation was she went to him and she found him and his love for her just the way it had been in the former time, still budding, still growing, as she expresses that in poetic language. And then the beloved and his friends sing out, "Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon you." And then the Shulamite says, "And what would you see in the Shulamite? As it were, the dance of the double camp." And so, you know, talking about her life, as they would gaze upon her, Solomon would gaze upon her, "It's beautiful as a beautiful dance." And then the beloved says, as their intimacy, they return to the intimacy with one another hasn't been hindered by this failure. And he says, "How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter. The curves of your thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a skillful workman. Your navel is a rounded goblet which lacks no blended beverage. Your waist is a heap of wheat." And the idea there is, you know, how they cinch the wheat in when they tie it. "And set about with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower, and your eyes are like the pools in Heshbon," and in that probably blue eyes, "by the gate of Bath Rabim. Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon." Now this, he seems to falter here just a bit. Needless to say, the Tower of Lebanon must have been a very beautiful tower, and a smaller tower at that. And so probably he's saying it was probably a tower renowned for beauty and beautifully shaped. And so he's saying, "You got a good-looking nose, girl." And so, well, maybe not quite like that. He says, "Which looks towards Damascus. Your head crowns you like Mount Carmel. You're majestic in how you carry yourself again. And the hair of your head is like purple," purple being a rich item. "Your hair is rich, it's full. The king is held captive by its tresses." Oh, "Your hair is so beautiful, it holds me captive. How fair and how pleasant you are, O love, with your delights. This stature of yours is like a palm tree." Again, the stately posture with which she probably carried herself. "And your breasts like its clusters. I said, I will go up to the palm tree and I will take hold of its branches. Let now your breasts be like clusters of the vine, the fragrance of your breath like apples, and the roof of your mouth like the best wine." And so the intimacy of their relationship unhindered, even though that was the area in which a bit of a failure occurred. And then the Shulamite says, "The wine goes down smoothly for my beloved, moving gently the lips of sleepers." And so it's just saying they're kissing a lot right there at the end of verse 9. "I am my beloved's and his desire is toward me." And then she says, "Come, my beloved, let us." And you'll see the repetition of us. In other words, she's saying, "I'm never going to let you go again. Come, my beloved, let us go forth to the field. Let us lodge in the villages. Let us get up early to the vineyards. Let us see if the vine has budded, whether the grape blossoms are open and the pomegranates are in bloom. And there I will give you my love. The mandrakes give off a fragrance. And at our gates are pleasant fruits, all manner new and old, which I have laid up for you, my beloved." And then she says, "Oh, that you were like my brother who nursed at my mother's breasts. If I could find you outside, I would kiss you and would not be despised. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, she who used to instruct me. I would cause you to drink of spiced wine, of the juice of my pomegranate." Now, in the Middle Eastern culture, and very much in the Asian culture today, they're very, very modest in even when you're married, in terms of outward physical affection. For instance, in India, when you go to India, it is very common to see men holding hands, walking down the street, and they just kind of take hold of two fingers.
all over the place, men holding hands, walking down the street. But you'll never see a man holding hands with his wife. You never see them walking side by side. And so in that culture, it was very, very unusual. You would not express your love out in the public setting. It was just socially taboo. And so what she's saying is, I wish I could not only, you know, love you in private and show my affection and be playful with you in private, but I wish, you know, we could hold hands and show our affection in the public setting, like I used to be able to do with my kid brother when we were kids. And so she remembers how with her kid brother, they'd hold hands and you could skip and you could kiss and you could just mess around and be kids in public and nobody would despise it because that's just brother and sister, they're kids. And she's saying, oh, I wish I didn't have to refrain even one moment of the day from showing affection to you, whether in private or in public. And then she says to the daughters of Jerusalem, his left hand is under my head and his right hand embraces me. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not stir nor awaken love until it pleases. And so she continues to encourage them. This marriage relationship and the physical relationship within it is Israel. And she's come from this obscure little village in the area of northern Israel near Lebanon someplace. And now here's the queen came from this town and now she's coming to visit us. You can imagine what a hubbub it would create within a town if that were to happen. So the famous queen returns home. And a relative declares, as he sees them coming in the distance, he says, who is this coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? I awakened you under the apple tree. There your mother brought you forth, and there she who bore you brought you forth. And so someone in the village sees her coming and gets excited and then begins to remember, oh, I remember you and just this and this, and the remembrances. And then in verse 6, as the Shulamite and Solomon come into the city, she makes a fresh commitment of her love to him and asks the same of him. She said, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. Let me never leave your heart. Let me never leave your arm. For love is as strong as death. She says this is one of the most beautiful descriptions of love in all of the Bible, this side of 1 Corinthians 13. For love is as strong as death. In other words, it's irresistible. It's irresistible when it comes. Jealousy is as cruel as the grave. Jealousy is a killer of relationships and marriage. Its flames are a flame of fire, a most vehement flame. Many waters cannot quench love. In other words, love prevails. And Paul writing in the Corinthians, he says, love never fails. Love perseveres. Nor can the floods drown it. If a man would give for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly despised. In other words, she's saying, a man cannot buy this kind of love for all of the money in the world. And if he tried to, his money would be despised. It's a rich man that has that kind of love. Can't be bought. And when you have it, you are a rich person. I'll tell you, I'm a rich person. And then the Shulamite's brothers, they kind of jump in. Apparently there's a little sister involved. And they say, we have a little sister, and she has no breasts. And so she hasn't grown up yet. And what shall we do for our sister in the day when she is spoken for? If she's a wall, we'll build upon her a battlement of silver. And if she's a door, we'll enclose her with boards of cedar. And so they said, tell us what we should do with her in order that she might have the same end that you have. What did you do, Shulamite? What did you do that caused, you know, you to end up with the marriage and the relationship that you ended up with? In order that your little sister might have the same kind of attractiveness and the same kind of life, what should we do? Should we make her a wall And if she's a wall, should we decorate her and make her attractive? In other words, did Solomon come into your life because of your attractiveness? Is that why you have the life that you have? Or should we protect her? And that's what the enclosed door means. That should we protect her? Or so should we decorate her, or should we protect her that she may have the same thing happen to her as happened to you? And what they're saying is, was it your beauty or was it your purity that attracted him? Was it your beauty or was it your purity that attracted him? And her answer is so outrageous. Verse 10. She said, I am a wall and my breasts like towers. And then I became in his eyes as one who found peace. And she answers that the key to the blessing of her married life is not just that she was pure and not just that she was beautiful, but that she waited for a man who considered such things valuable. What good is being pure and being beautiful if you don't wait for a man who considers those things valuable? That's what she's saying. I think that's outrageously wonderful. In verse 11, she likens herself to a vineyard that isn't for hire. She said, Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon, and he leased the vineyard to keepers. Everyone was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. So Solomon leased out a lot of vineyards for a fee, and then she contrasts herself with the vineyards that are leased out for a fee or for people who sell themselves for a fee. She says in verse 12, to my own vineyard is before me. You, O Solomon, may have 1,000 and those who keep its fruit 200. And so what she's declaring to him is that unlike all of those other vineyards that he had control over, she's saying, you had no control over my vineyard. And the vineyard that I gave you, my vineyard, and I kept control of my vineyard so that I could give my vineyard to the man who loved me and the man that she loved and the man that loved her enough to marry her. And so she's talking about the fact that she had control of her body and she gave it to him as a gift from herself. And then the beloved, he says in verse 13, as it all kind of wraps down, as this is a, I love it. He said, you who dwell in the gardens, the companions, listen for your voice. Let me hear it. And so the idea is, if you've ever seen like Italian villages or Middle Eastern villages, apparently what's happened is she's come into town and there's a bit of a little plaza or a courtyard and there's so many people in the town. They've surrounded her. He can't even, you know, see her at all. And all of her friends all around her. She's the center of attention. And he loves it. He loves it. There's no jealousy there or anything like that. No pettiness. She's the center of attention and he loves it when she is the center of attention. And you notice he talks about her voice and he says, let me hear it. I don't need to see you. I don't want to disrupt what's going on. You know, you're the center of attention, the beauty of that. Just let me hear your voice. After all these years, he still loves the sound of her voice. Still loves the sound of her voice. Not just her outward beauty, but what she has to say. Because what she has to say is about her mind and about her heart. This man loves this woman inside and out. He just loves to hear her talk. That's a beautiful man. That's a beautiful husband. And then she responds in verse 14 and says, make haste, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. And so she responds with her desire for him. And over all of the years of their marriage, we don't know how long it was in the end of chapter 8 here, but over all of the years, the intimacy of the marriage hadn't diminished. It had grown. It had grown, and the longing for one another. Beautiful book, isn't it? Beautiful book. A beautiful celebration of married love. Beautiful celebration of the love that Jesus has for us. And so that intimacy in our relationship with the Lord, as the years go on,
grows more and more intimate. And just as she cries out, she longs for her beloved there in verse 14, the fullest intimacy of the relationship, so too in the revelation as it closes out in chapter 22, the Spirit and the bride say, come. We long, we love the intimacy that we have with the Lord, and we long for even greater intimacy the longer we walk with Him, to one day see Him face to face. Fabulous, fabulous song, this Song of Solomon.